Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. We continue with our just inaugurated exposition of the book of Micah, the Old Testament prophet. The word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, a vision he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Hear, you peoples, all of you, listen, earth and all who live in it, that the sovereign Lord may bear witness against you, the Lord, from his holy temple. And then Micah unveils, in the Lord's behalf, judgment against Samaria, capital of the northern kingdom, and Jerusalem, capital of the southern kingdom. In verse 6, he said, I will make Samaria a heap of rubble, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour her stones into the valley and lay bare her foundations. And her idols, oh, this was a huge problem. Her idols will be broken to pieces. All of her temple gifts will be burned with fire. I will destroy all her images. Since she gathered her gifts from the wages of prostitutes, as the wages of prostitutes, they will again be used. The Lord inveighs through Micah against idolatry in both the northern and the southern kingdoms. And judgment is going to come, though they are not mentioned, through the Assyrians. But as the last program was winding up, I was making an important contemporary application. There is a tendency for us to read these prophets and to not feel the pain, as it were, because we mentally insulate ourselves, or maybe isolate ourselves, from the sin of idolatry as though it's irrelevant, because none of us, I think at least, would be caught bowing down before a physical image, though there may be some who might do that, images of saints and others, and that too is idolatry. But there is another more subtle form of idolatry, and we hear it mentioned in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, where Paul speaks of greed or covetousness, avariciousness, as a form of idolatry, the love of money. No image required. So we must be careful here, and we must examine ourselves. God hates idolatry. You shall have no other gods before me, the very first commandment. An idol is anything that becomes in our lives, we allow it to become, more important to us than God. And that could be some things that we don't ordinarily think of as fitting anywhere near that category. For example, I have seen people come real close to making idols of their family, believe it or not. Family is the biggest thing in the world to them. That is so wrong when people will subordinate the worship and the will of God to their own family goals and ideals. I've seen it. I remember warning a young man one time, a young man in the ministry, about that very thing. He had on his radar a goal. It was a great ideal for him and his wife to have a whole tribe of children. I remember warning him that 1 Corinthians chapter 7 tells us, all believers, but that would apply most especially to ministers, not to allow ourselves to become encumbered by distractions so that we might serve the Lord. There are certain distractions that are necessary. They're just a part of the fabric of life. And if we get married, as Paul pointed out, we have a husband, we have a wife, well, there's a distraction. But God may not have given us the gift of celibacy, so it's not a sin to get married. And it's certainly not a sin to have children. And in fact, it's a good thing, I believe, if one can. Not everybody can. But in our day and time, the way life is structured in the modern era, it's not like it was in the ancient times where large families were necessary to survive. The point is that when you have a choice, you've got to be careful here. My wife and I had a choice. We were able to have children. We had two. I would have liked to have had more. I'd like somebody to take care of me when we get old and are no longer perhaps able to take care of ourselves. But we decided going into the ministry that we would probably never own a home. That was in the day when I entered the ministry, when pastors still had parsonages. I figured we would always have a low income. That's the way it usually was with pastors. And I did not see how we could support a large family. But in addition to just supporting them, there's the distraction of a large family. So we made that sacrifice, and I think we made that right choice. I never wanted it, as I told this young man, I never wanted it to come to the point where I was having to make financial decisions about my ministry that were based upon what I perceived as my family needs as opposed to what was the direction of God. Family can become an idol. You see it all the time. There's another idol that a lot of moderns have. It is idolatry. It is nothing less. You cannot serve God and serve an idol. With many, physical fitness is virtually a religion. Now, being physically fit is a good thing. But whenever that value becomes so important to a person that it transcends the worship and service of God, becomes so important that if push comes to shove, the pursuit of physical fitness will trump the pursuit of worship and the service of the living God. Hey, we have a problem. It's called idolatry. Go run, my friend, but run on your own time, not God's. What a trade-off. Physically fit, but spiritually unfit. See, idolatry is a modern problem. It wasn't just a problem in Samaria. It wasn't just a problem in Jerusalem, where idols were virtually on every corner. You see, we can exonerate ourselves too easily from the idolatry issue that the ancient prophets so vigorously condemned. And that's because we have too narrow a mental model of that evil, and we lapse right into it. And we even commend ourselves sometimes for our idols, plain and simple. One of the commoner idols I see today is the pursuit of a relationship. Many people out there are lonely. We can all understand loneliness. They're emotionally needy for whatever reasons. What they want more than anything else in life is not God. They may be in church, they may be duly baptized, they may call themselves Christians. But when push comes to shove, what they want is a fulfilling relationship with some flesh and blood person. And in a New York minute, they will make the things of God secondary or even cast him behind their backs altogether when God's will and God's worship get in the way of that human relationship. Other idols people chase after that are not always as easily recognized as the false gods they really are such things as the brass ring of success, spell that with a capital S, whatever that goal may mean to a given person, or some financial goal. A young man I once knew wanted to be a millionaire. That was his goal. That was the most important thing in his life. He was in our church in Denver. He wanted to be a millionaire by the age 30, and you know what? He was. But that's an idol. I knew another guy who plotted his course to becoming a billionaire. However, in the grace and mercy of God, that goal crashed. Jesus said it, I mentioned it earlier, the last segment, you cannot serve God and mammon, mammon meaning wealth, or any other person or value. I think by now I have sufficiently illustrated the many more subtle directions that the spirit of idolatry may take us believers, and in the end may prove us to be just churchy hypocrites as we go on professing to worship God, even as in the process we cling to some idol. It's an idol because it's something more important to us than serving and worshiping the true and living God. And what may be even worse is confusing the serving of those idols like family with the worship of God. Whatever you would not sacrifice for the sake of Christ, if required, is an idol, a god, a false god. So, after all of that illustration, My friend, if you are an idolater, the God of Micah, understand, is just as displeased with you and your idolatry as he was with Judah and Samaria. In principle, there's no difference. The timing of his judgment and the forms of it may be different, but it is inevitable if we follow in the path of idolatry. And that's why the Lord called the nations, in verse 2, to bear witness to his quarrel with Samaria and Judah. Same song, just a different verse. Well, in verse 8, we have weeping and mourning. Here the prophet, his heart broken as in his vision, he is allowed to see the ruin and destruction that will follow in the dust of the, though not mentioned, the Assyrian war wagons, as that vicious conqueror descends from the north as God's instrument of judgment. Because of this, the prophet says, I will go weeping and wail. I will go about barefoot and naked. I will howl like a jackal and moan like an owl. For Samaria's plague is incurable. It has spread to Judah. It has reached the very gate of my people, even to Jerusalem itself. Oh, tell it not in Gath. Weep not at all in Beth Ophrah. Roll in the dust. We'll stop right there. So prophet weeps. He speaks by means of word pictures and word plays as he addresses Judean cities. He addresses 10 of them because 10 is a number to Hebrews that was often used to project the notion of completeness, not because only 10 cities of Judah will be affected when the judgment of God moves south and reaches them. The Hebrew prophets were very fond of word plays. Those who know Hebrew well can appreciate those word plays a lot better than the English reader. In Hebrew, they're very clever. Often, however, those subtleties do not come through as effectively in our English translations, so just be aware of that. Sometimes the very name of these cities and Judean towns that Micah mentions next, the very name will have a specific meaning that he plays on in his judicial address. Sometimes the town name in Hebrew just naturally evokes another Hebrew word that sounds very similar and therefore invites the word play. Micah describes his pain in powerful figures here from verses 8 and moving on to the end of the chapter. We can relate, as much as we know our own beloved country is so full of idolatry and every form of ungodliness, and we know our own country is begging for divine judgment at every turn. If it turns cataclysmic at some point, and like an avalanche of destruction and ruination, we would see our own country turned upside down, see slaughter everywhere, see blood running in the streets, see enemies razing our national monuments, and wrecking everything on the right and left. Well, you can just imagine how terrible we would feel to be witnesses of all that, as much as we would know that our nation deserves all the hell that heaven has dumped on it. Well, that kind of imagination puts us mentally on the horizon of the prophet Micah. In his vision, he sees all this going down. God gave him this vision. He sees the overthrow of proud, wicked Samaria, to be followed at some point by the descent of the Assyrian horde upon Judah and Jerusalem itself. The visual prospect just overwhelmed him. Of course, his own pain will be similarly magnified in the hearts of the citizens of Samaria and Judah. He speaks for all of them in verse 8. Because of this, I will weep and even wail. I will go about barefoot and naked as a sign of lament, he means. I will howl like a jackal and moan like an owl. In the IVP, Biblical Background Commentary, the editors mentioned that these were sounds, quote, often heard in the wilderness and the wastelands of the country. Both make a piercing sound that could chill the soul and hint of death. When Micah says, I will go barefoot and naked, that's perhaps a relative term. Perhaps he means stripped down to a loincloth. Naked to us might be running around in our underwear. This language of Micah reflects a mourning ritual. The Hebrews, not alone among the ancients, they were far more elaborately and formally expressive of great grief than we are in our Western cultures. In our cultures, there is, I would opine, a rather contrary emphasis on tamping it down, hiding grief. Today, for some good reasons, sometimes for worse reasons, we have memorial rather than funeral services. Celebrations of life rather than a mourning of death. How well I remember at my age the praise of Jackie Kennedy and her stoic, tearless manner at the bier of JFK. The Eastern way, I'm talking about the ancient Near East, is a lot more messy, but it may be a good deal healthier than our stuff-it mode. In any case, verse 9, the prophet describes the descent of judgment in the form of the invaders as a deadly plague, an incurable one. It has spread south to Judah. In fact, it has reached the very gate of my people, even Jerusalem itself. As if watching a movie reel, Micah describes the onslaught as like a deadly plague flowing through Samaria, the capital of the 10 northern tribes, then moving like a violent floodwater into Judah, reaching eventually to the very gates of Jerusalem. In ancient cities, the gate was more or less the business district where the leading men of the city met and discharged their business. What is most interesting about this prediction is that, in fact, in Judea, the gates of Jerusalem was as far as the Assyrians ever got. That would not be the case with the Babylonians much later, but as far as the Assyrians ever got. They were never able to lay siege to Jerusalem itself, though they did run riot and ran savagely through the rest of Judea under Sennacherib after Tiglath-Pileser overthrew the northern kingdom and its capital Samaria in 722-721 B.C. In verse 10, Micah says, "Tell it not in Gath, that's a Philistine city, weep not at all, in Beth Ophrah, roll in the dust." It's extremely distressing when patriots see their enemies given occasion of gloating over the distress or disaster that may strike their country. Not even the prophet Micah, the friend of an indignant God, cherishes the thought of the cheering of the Philistines and the jeering at the calamity of his people. Do you remember how indignant we in the United States were way back on the occasion of 9/11, where we saw stories and pictures of some in the Arab world, and the Palestinians in particular, jumping with joy in the streets at the killing of all of those innocent people? Since then, we've seen similar jubilation many times in parts of the Muslim world when ISIS or the Taliban or some other related terrorist group has sponsored and executed some kind of massacre here or abroad. Well, Micah saw all of that about to come down, in his vision, that is. It was a judgment of God about to descend from heaven itself, and every bit of it richly deserved. Micah the prophet has no quarrel with that. Still, as a human being who loved his people, wicked and as deserving of the wrath of a holy God as they were, he loved his country. So it was hard to see, just as it is hard to watch an evil person executed, however deserving they are of it. And what makes something like that still harder is the fact that those even more wicked still are getting the satisfaction of gloating like the Philistines. David, who succeeded King Saul, had that same sorrow at the death of King Saul, who so richly deserved to go down. In expressing his thought, Micah the prophet borrows from the poetic lament of King David in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 2, for the death of Saul. "Please," Micah says, "don't let anyone run and tell what is happening to Judea in Gath, the bitter enemy of Israel, that major Philistine city along the Mediterranean coast. Don't anybody tell them the glory is gone." In the rest of this lament, Micah selects, as I mentioned earlier, 10 place names in various directions and distances from Jerusalem. Not all of these sites are we able to identify today, but serving to indicate the sweep of the tide of judgment from north to south. That's their purpose. What especially serves Micah's purpose addressing these 10 towns is that all 10 have names with meanings, or names that evoke words by the similarity of their sound, that he's able to play upon to accentuate the theme of impending judgment and subsequent disaster on the way. For example, the end of verse 10, second half. Beth means house. Beth Ophrah in Hebrew means house of dust. Fittingly, Micah says Beth Ophrah, under the indignant hand, will roll in the dust. There's the wordplay. In verse 11, pass by naked and in shame, you who live in Shafir, and those who live in Zanan will not come out. Beth Ezel is in mourning. It no longer protects you. All of those are towns with wordplays on their names. Shafir, the name meant pleasant. It will be everything but on the day of God's visitation. When they are led away by the enemy, they will pass by as if a review stand naked and in shame, not a shred of her former pleasantness remaining. Some of these are not significant towns, but again, I remind you, they're selected for mention, because they, along with their neighbors, will be targets of the Assyrian forces passing through, and their names just happen to bear or suggest meanings expressive of the awful effects. So with Zanah in verse 11, it means come out. For the wicked residents of that town, there will be no coming out, implying they all will be hemmed in by the enemy and perhaps slaughtered. Beth Ezel, the fourth city named at the end of verse 11. The meaning is less certain. It may mean taken away. If so, the idea seems to be that the house of Ezel is taken away so that it no longer affords its citizens any protection. The town may have been located on the east side of Jerusalem. Maroth, verse 12, means bitter. Those who live in Maroth writhe in pain, waiting for relief, because disaster has come from the Lord even to the gate of Jerusalem. A fitting name in a time of judgment, Maroth, because those who reside there will writhe in bitter pain, waiting vainly for relief. In verse 13, this is a major city, Lachish. Lachish sounds like the Hebrew word for team. It was a strong strategic fortress city, approximately 30 miles southwest of Jerusalem, 15 miles or so west of Hebron. It dominated the old road from the Palestinian highland to the Nile Valley, so says Unger's Bible Dictionary. The Assyrian king Sennacherib, who invaded Judah in the time of Hezekiah, was so proud of capturing it that he decorated his palace at Nineveh with reliefs picturing his exploits. Find that in a note in the NIV Study Bible, page 15-103. The leaders of Lachish, playing on the name, which sounds like a word for team, are warned to harness a team of fast horses to a chariot, because the Assyrians are coming for them. They had better run and run fast, for terror was on its way. No wonder, the prophet reminds them, you are where the sin of the daughter of Zion, Jerusalem, began, for the transgressions of Israel, the idolatry of the 10 northern tribes. It spread from there, it came to Lachish. Now prepare, Lachish, for divine retribution. The chickens have come home to roost, as we always said back in the hills of West Virginia. On verse 13, now you will give parting gifts to Moresheth-Gath. The town of Aksib will prove deceptive to the kings of Israel. The name Moresheth sounds like a Hebrew word that connotes a bridal gift or some kind of present. Micah appears to be saying that his hometown will be a gift for the invaders. The town of Aksib, the eighth town, means deceptive. It will in some way prove deceptive like a dry well to the kings of Israel, meaning of no use or support for them in the time of the coming invasion. In verse 15, a mighty conqueror is coming, and that is so fitting in the case of you who live in Marishah, the tenth name. The name means conquer. A conqueror will come to his namesake. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.